Radio.
Challenges to Christian Anthropology in Today's World. A Canon Law Perspective. A presentation by Father Mark Podesta at the Christopher Dawson Center for Cultural Studies 2016 Colloquium.
So today, obviously, we know that civil recognition of same-sex marriages and gender fluidity are major contemporary moral issues. That's why we're here today. Maybe to take up an overused idiom, we could argue that dealing with these issues of sexuality are the most important moral issues of our time. Today's contemporary secular beliefs extol the rights of the homosexual person, demanding the same rights as heterosexual couples relating to areas such as marriage and adoption. When I was at university, you know, university is obviously a hotbed for political activism, the gay lobby at university fought ardently against the concept of gay marriage, seeing marriage as, to coin a phrase that was used, pushing the parameters of the patriarchal paradigm, the heterosexual paradigm, against which they sought to fight. Yet today, the gay lobby engages in a quest for equality, so the nature of the conversation has changed. My talk today seeks to explore the legal sphere with respect to these issues. As a canon lawyer, and not as a secular or a civil lawyer, I'm not qualified to speak about civil matters with any more expertise than anyone else here at this colloquium. Yet I have some basic reflections that I'd like to share and I hope will be thought-provoking. Before I share some canonical implications with you, I want to begin with a survey of our contemporary situation. As a priest, I am approaching this discussion, of course, as a Catholic, as a Christian. The Christian perception of homosexuality is obviously incongruous with this contemporary demand for equal recognition of same-sex unions under the title of marriage. Pope Francis has done much to emphasize the dignity and the value of the homosexual person. As religious leaders, we seek to understand these issues through the eyes of God's intention for humanity, and that's what I'll be attempting to do. As human beings, we all long to love and to be loved. This longing is imprinted on us in our very being. We are created as beings who seek completion. The love we truly long for is the love of God, yet satisfied in this life here on earth by seeking to unify ourselves with another human being. One of the major problems of the debate today is that we have lost a literacy of what it is to be a human person. The masses seem to have lost sight of God's plan for humanity. Instead, humanity seeks freedom, a freedom to choose, a freedom to live one's life as one chooses or as one is compelled. Freedom. If there is one word that might encapsulate the spirit of the Western world today, I propose that freedom would fit the bill. Yet freedom is a concept which is greatly misunderstood. Freedom is often misunderstood to mean the ability to do what one wants, with no regard for any concept of natural order, of that which God intended. As an enlightened and modern society, we've been deeply infected by relativism. Pope Benedict XVI strove to address the dangers of relativism. And we know the mantra, as long as I'm not hurting anyone else, then I should be able to do what I want. This line is pursued by the mainstream media and the broadcasting industry, slowly but surely forming the minds of the masses. This is an example I often like to quote when discussing this issue. In the early 1990s, there was a television show that was quite popular, produced in America, Murphy Brown. It followed the life of a successful single female journalist after whom the show was named. At that time, the 1990s, the story saw the lead character have a baby out of wedlock. This caused an absolute uproar. It was seen as an attack on decency and the thin edge of the wedge. Fancy a television show, a mainstream show, portraying a mother having a child out of wedlock. This went right up to the White House, where the vice president at the time condemned the storyline. 1990s. Now, fast forward some 30 years. We have shows like Modern Family that present the reality of many different ways family are composed today, including inclusion of a same-sex couple raising a child. Days of Our Lives, I am told, recently portrayed a same-sex marriage uniting two young men as a central part of its storyline, uniting two dynastic families. The Bold and the Beautiful, I am told, has a storyline where a man has transitioned into a woman and married the heir to the fortunes of the lead family of the soap opera. They're not side stories. These are central plots to the shows. And then, of course, we have prominent homosexual celebrities such as Ellen DeGeneres, a very likable woman, seems very nice, lobbying and has lobbied for same-sex marriage. We know now that same-sex marriage is a reality in America, and we are facing the prospect of perhaps a divisive plebiscite here in Australia in the next term of government, should the incumbent be re-elected, or having the legislation forced through Parliament, should the federal opposition claim victory in the polls next week. Remember, only 30 years ago, storyline, uproar for a woman having a child out of wedlock. The world has changed so much, so quickly, in such a short period of time. It's less of a case of bracket creep and perhaps more of the case of bracket leap. Let's return to this concept of freedom. May I propose an analogy which many of you may be familiar with, that of the pianist. I'll be honest with you, I can't play the piano. If I go up to a piano and I sit down and I begin to hit the keys, the piano is going to make a sound, but it's going to sound terrible. As an individual, I have the freedom to hit whichever keys I choose, but it doesn't make music. However, if I were to submit myself to years of diligent lessons, I would come to understand, I would think, the rules surrounding which tones sound assonant when played together and which tones sound dissonant when played together. I would understand the rules of playing the piano and I would become a proficient pianist. Ironically, my ability to be truly free to make beautiful music would be based upon an understanding of music and a restriction of which keys I could hit at any given moment. The restriction would lead to true freedom. That's such an irony. Rules providing freedom. I propose this as an analogy to start with that might assist us in understanding this topic today. Freedom and the quest for individual rights at all costs can be seen in the Constitution of the United States of America. Here in Australia, we're incredibly influenced by America, whether it's in a financial setting or a moral setting. There's the old saying, when America sneezes, Australia catches a cold. But many of us don't really know or understand that the Constitution of the Commonwealth of Australia is very different to the Constitution of the United States of America, a country which prides itself on being the land of the free. The Constitution of America starts with the rights of the individual upon which the nation is built. On the other hand, the Constitution of Australia does not start with the rights of individuals. Rather, it speaks of what Australia is as a nation and the powers it has to interact with the community. Whereas America is a state built on the aspirations of individuals with inalienable rights, in Australia the state is the institutional embodiment of sovereignty and power. It exists to preserve community life in a manner that is consonant with personal dignity and individual freedom. This intent in part explains the limited, explicit freedoms enumerated in the Australian Constitution and its concern in places to restrain Commonwealth power. So the Australian Constitution doesn't begin with a consideration of individuals and their rights, and contrary to common belief, the Australian Constitution does not give us the right to free speech or any other such rights. read the Constitution and you're not going to see all Australians have the right to freedom of speech. But that doesn't mean that we don't have this right. The Australian Constitution considers the citizens of our country as a community, and it defines the role that the state has in its interaction with this body. Interestingly, the Australian Constitution does not afford a freedom from religious interference. On the contrary, Article 116 ensures that religion is going to be free from interference of the state. This is misunderstood by most when we speak about the separation of church and state. People say that the church shouldn't interfere in the state, affairs of the state, but the contrary is true, that the state should not be telling religion what to do. In any case, the Australian Constitution protects the rights of the community, not the rights of individuals. Our Constitution is very different from the Constitution of America. This is perhaps why we consider mateship, altruism, and a fair go as hallmarks of the Australian spirit. Australia, as much of the Western world, has been influenced by this misunderstood pursuit of individual freedom. It's a misunderstanding of the very concept of freedom. It is this misunderstanding of freedom, freedom at all costs, that leads to the American obsession with the right to bear arms. Ironically, it is this right that enabled, at least in part, the hate crimes such as the recent massacre in Orlando, Florida, where 49 people were gunned down as they were gathered together to celebrate their freedom. A massacre of free individuals that was enabled by one man's right, individual right, to bear arms. Individual rights need to be balanced with the good of society. The right to freedom needs to be understood in tandem with our responsibilities as human beings. Today we speak so much of rights, but very little of responsibilities. This is something which, when I finally get to discussing canon law after this framework is set up, we see that we have both rights and responsibilities. We have the responsibility as human citizens, as a part of God's plan, to see that God's plan is fulfilled in the world. It's only when we have a proper understanding of freedom that we can approach these contemporary debates surrounding sexuality, gender, and rights. Now, let me turn to a Christian understanding of these issues. The Catholic Church teaches in the Catechism that God, by his infinite wisdom and love, brings into existence all of reality as a reflection of his goodness. He fashions mankind, male and female, in his own image and likeness. Human beings, therefore, are nothing less than the work of God himself. And in the complementarity of the sexes, they are called to reflect the inner unity of the Creator. They do this in a striking way in their cooperation with him in the transmission of life by a mutual donation of the self to the other. End quote. The Church's teaching on sexuality is fundamentally wound up in the creation story in the book of Genesis. Man and woman are created not equal to each other, but complementary to one another. This is not a discussion of the dignity of the human person. Man and woman are created in the image and likeness of God and thus possess an inherent equality of dignity. That's not being debated. But here we're speaking about a difference in being, a complementarity. Each is created for the other. A human person is not a sexually undifferentiated entity. On this understanding, a human person is a sexual being. All of us are either male or female persons. Two equal but sexually differentiated and complementary words or images of the Trinity, God, who is, of course, without gender, without sex. We think about the word sex. Sex comes from that verb which means literally to cut or to divide or to separate. So we can see that in the coming together of a man and a woman, the two who are sexed or cut or divided become one whole, just as God is complete. As such, we can't just simply dismiss sex as being irrelevant. It's not just a characteristic of who we are, like our hair color or our height or our eye color. Our sex is a crucial, fundamental part of who we are and how we relate to others. Being male or female is not simply biological, precisely because the body of a human person is not just an instrument or a tool of the person, something other than the person, but our bodies are constitutive of our very being and our expression. Popular culture often proposes that we are spirits trapped in fleshly bodies, and that when we die, we'll be free from our bodies, our earthly prisons, and we can fly around as free as birds. This is a misunderstanding of the human person. Obviously, the body and the soul are inextricably linked. It's because our sex is such a fundamental part of who we are that our sex governs the way we interact with one another. Sexuality affects all aspects of the human person in the unity of body and soul. It especially concerns affectivity, the capacity to love and to procreate, and in a more general way, the aptitude for forming bonds of communion with others. Sex plays an important part in the very being of our existence. To be a man is to lack all that there is in being a woman, and to be a woman is to lack all that there is in being a man. Men and women have been created in a way that is complementary to one another. When the two combine, the unity provides all that was previously lacking. When a man and a woman combine, the two become one flesh and are made complete, just as God is complete in God's self. God lacks nothing. It is us, as sexed persons, who are lacking and seek completion. That completion which ultimately leads to union with God, but in this life with another person. This is what St. John Paul II referred to when he spoke about the nuptial meaning of the body. The primary reason why a man and a woman come together in the sexual act according to God's plan for creation is to participate in his creation by procreating. If the purpose for a man and a woman coming together in the sexual act is to participate in God's design, then the natural extension, and thus the foundation of the law of this, is that to not participate in God's design is flawed, and so therefore any other form of sexual union is regarded as unnatural. The Church teaches that genital acts must be open to the potential for procreation, and that procreation is a fundamental God-given purpose and gift of sexual intercourse, and that any sexual expression that excludes the possibility of procreation is unnatural. We don't limit this just to homosexual acts, but to all acts outside of marriage, including sex before marriage of a heterosexual couple. The Church isn't singling out homosexuals. In fact, we know that Pope Francis seeks to reach out to all people. We understand that sexual union is a gift, a right, and a responsibility between a man and a woman in the covenant of marriage, and not outside of it. We are taught that to choose someone of the same sex for one sexual activity is perhaps to annul the rich symbolism and meaning, not to mention the goals, of the Creator's sexual design. Homosexual activity is not a complementary union able to transmit life. The Catholic Church does not teach that to be homosexual is sinful. Rather than being sinful, the Catholic Church chooses to use the word disorder. The Catechism says, again, although the particular inclination of the homosexual person is not a sin, it is a more or less strong tendency ordered toward an intrinsic moral evil, and thus the inclination itself must be seen as an objective disorder. That's what the Catholic Church says about it in the Catechism. It's considered to be a disorder because it's not understood to be in line with the natural order of the complementarity of man and woman. We can turn disorder into a scary word. A disorder is not saying it's a disease or it's something horrible. Disorder means it's something different to the natural order. The church does not teach that being homosexual is sinful. Sin is an act, not a way of being. Sin must involve a personal choice, and if there's no choice, then there can't be sin. Whether it's the product of an inborn characteristic or the environment, many people believe it is no longer reasonable to see homosexuality when considered an orientation as a moral failing. In summary, for the Catholic Church, to be homosexual is not sinful. To participate in homosexual acts or any act outside of marriage, that is sinful. So how do we address the push for same-sex marriage in contemporary society today? As well as perhaps encouraging a correct understanding of freedom, as we spoke about before, and perhaps we could encourage a study of philosophy among our youth so that we can engage in such conversations, we might want to consider the promotion of a unitive understanding of the human person. Many people today have a separatist view of sexuality, separating the purpose and the end of marriage, of sex, from the act of sex itself. So to become pregnant as a result of sexual union is a side effect. It's not the purpose. That's what we mean by separatist, separating what we do from what its purpose is. The understanding of human sexuality dominant in our culture can be described as separatist. It has severed the existential and psychological bond between the life-giving or procreative meaning of human sexuality and its person-uniting, love-giving, unitive meaning. It regards the former simply as a biological function of sexuality. We seek a unitive understanding of humanity and sexuality, an understanding of human anthropology, which recognizes the procreative dimension of sexuality with the unitive dimension of sexuality. When all this is done, the disordered nature of the homosexual act, not the person, but the act, may be much more clearly understood. Many people believe that homosexuality and homosexual activity is unitive. Well, at least they're a strong, loving couple and they want to live with each other for the rest of their lives. They complete each other. They feel secure with each other. They look after each other. They've found a lifelong partner. That seems to be unitive. The reality of the procreative dimension of the human person can be seen in the desire for the right of same-sex couples to adopt. They want to participate, or perhaps to use surrogacy or donation so that they can procreate themselves. The Church asks homosexuals to grow in their awareness of the created order of the world and the will of God in reserving sexual union to the married state. For the Catholic Church, by being chaste, homosexuals can fully participate in the life of the Church. They dedicate their lives to understanding the nature of God's personal call to them. They're able then to celebrate the sacrament of penance more faithfully and receive the Lord's grace freely offered so that they can convert their lives more fully to God's way. All of us are called to personal sanctification. We're all called to be chaste in however we live our lives. So too, homosexual persons are called to chastity. The church acknowledges that this isn't easy, that it requires self-mastery so that they can participate perhaps in disinterested friendships. They need to pray like we all need to pray. They need sacramental grace like we need sacramental grace. We all seek Christian perfection. The duty of seeking personal sanctification is not a simple task. Usually it's easier, we know, to just go with the flow and to give in to our desires. But the important thing is we are not simply animals. We're not enslaved by our passions. Yes, we are weak, and we can often opt for the path of least resistance, or in this case, perhaps the path of greatest pleasure. But we don't have to be slaves to our desires. As human beings, we're greater than this. We understand that all of us created in God's likeness are called to perfection. We're called to grow in holiness. a life of chaste celibacy for homosexuals may be the answer. Proposing such a life may seem far-fetched to someone who's really into the gay lifestyle. But many people who have made heterosexual acts part of their life adjustment have learned to live without genital sexuality. Widows, divorced persons, those who have entered religious life, after living as adults with no commitment to celibacy or chastity. We are greater than our passions. We all make choices in life, and some of these choices are particularly difficult. Some challenges seem insurmountable. I just can't do it. The least we need to do is to offer understanding, encouragement, and guidance, rather than hatred or bigotry or misunderstanding. We're all on this journey together, and many of our struggles are shared. In the law of the Catholic Church in particular, changes in civil law or secular law recognizing same-sex marriage, adoption, or gender fluidity require a response. Let's consider, for example, two men who marry each other and adopt a child. Legally, they are recognized as being guardians or parents of this child. Then they come to the Catholic Church and they present their child for baptism. I understand that canon law prohibits me as a priest from refusing the baptism of a child unless there's no chance of a Christian upbringing. So what do I do as a priest in a parish? If this child is being raised by a same-sex couple, is there a chance of being raised as a Christian? And then if I go ahead and I perform the baptism, do I record both men as parents of the child in the church's register of baptisms? When they come to enroll the child at school, do I regard both men as parents on the child's school enrollment form? As a representative of the church, if I accept the reality of their union, does that mean that then I'm accepting such unions are accepted by the church? What do I do if I'm a parish priest of a parish, there's a parish school, and there's a 10-year-old girl who publicly declares that she's really a boy and begins the process of transition? Can I accept this in a church school? Can the government then compel the church to accept such a transitioning child? Will there be uproar afterwards if we find that the child doesn't belong in the school? What help do we offer these people? If a person who was born a man but has legally been recognized as a woman asks us to change their gender, their sex, in the register of the parish, what do I do? Do I cross out male and put female, or cross out female and put male? Can a person who was born a man but now lives their life as a woman join a convent and be a nun? What if a member of the clergy publicly declares that he's really a woman and is recognized by the state as such? We have to keep in mind Article 116 again of the Australian Constitution, which protects the church from the interference of the state. Might the state one day, though, nevertheless try to force the church to recognise same-sex marriage? When preparing a heterosexual couple for marriage, I normally start by asking if either of them have been married before. Clearly, in the Catholic Church, since we don't recognise civil divorce, if either of them have been married before, they can't be enter into a new marriage because they're impeded by the impediment of prior bond. What if they've been married to a member of the same sex and then go on to get divorced? On the church paperwork, their marital status will be regarded as never having been married, but on the state paperwork, they'll be regarded as having been divorced. I don't have all the answers, but I think we can see that more and more of these conundrums and questions are going to come up. Some may fear that churches will be forced to recognise same-sex marriage or even conduct same-sex marriages. I'd like to see a focus on this Article 116 of the Australian Constitution to remind the government it's not about the church not interfering with the state, it's about the state not interfering with the church. It's a constitutional right. And if they asked us to recognise same-sex marriage, then I think that that ought to be challenged. Personally, if that were to happen, I would not be opposed to the Catholic Church withdrawing from that group of institutions that have authorised marriage celebrants recognised by the state. I can then see the merit. This is my opinion. I don't know what the church's opinion is. I can see merit in couples then obtaining a civil marriage license, as they do in other countries, and then coming to the church for their marriage to be actually recognised, for it to become a church marriage. In an ideal world, we would claim intellectual ownership of the word marriage. So we would use marriage, and the state would use another word. So first they'd go to the court to be able to get their contract, and then they would come to the church so that they could be married. I've even heard someone refer to, perhaps gay marriage could be referred to as garage. Look, these questions are not easily answered. So what's the way forward for us? It seems that while we must go forward bearing witness to the truth, we can't bring about an awareness of this truth when we don't understand one another. At this point, our society is incredibly divided on this issue. We are competing in a battle of ideologies, and the victor is often the group with the loudest voice. But shouting at each other achieves little. It is as though we are speaking different languages. We're not engaging in discussion. We're talking at each other, not with each other. In particular, the media is giving enough coverage of the pro-same-sex marriage cause that the other side is being drowned out. Both sides need to engage in sincere and respectful dialogue. While changes are not inevitable, as proponents of maintaining the status quo, I guess we can't afford to ignore what might be the writing of the wall. It seems that public sentiment, formed by the media with a set agenda, as well as this infiltration of relativism in our thinking, has largely decided that it's probably inevitable that same-sex marriage will receive civil recognition. Doesn't mean it's fait accompli, but it seems like it's going that way. Many people, while not militantly lobbying for same-sex marriage, seem to accept its recognition as harmless and perhaps justified. For the rest of us, while our fundamental understanding of the human person won't change, we have to look at ways that we will respond if this were the case. Canon law doesn't currently have the ability to answer these pressing social questions of the day. The current code of canon law of the church was written and promulgated after Vatican II in 1983 and is a product of its time. For example, there are canons in the code of canon law that refer to the use of social media, but in 1983, social media was the radio and TV, and maybe newspapers. There was no Facebook or Twitter or Skype or Instagram or Vine or Periscope or internet. The code wasn't written with this in mind. So we're going to need to adapt. And I know that as a canon lawyer for the Archdiocese of Sydney and other people who consult me, they ask me, what do we do in this situation? I've got two women who want to enroll their child. Should I do it? Will I get in trouble if I do it? Does the church have an answer? And at this stage, I can only give my advice, but we don't have a solution. I'm hoping that the bishops as well will collectively come up with a response. Coming up with a response doesn't mean that we accept that it's inevitable, but it means that we're forearmed, that we're prepared, so that if it does happen, we're not falling behind on the back foot, but that we're going to be ready. So as I finish up, I'll just say that what I've tried to do in this talk today is I couldn't talk a lot about canon law without having the foundation of the understanding of a couple of things, understanding that we speak different languages, that we're talking at each other rather than with each other, that we need to push ourselves, promote ourselves, not as being motivated by hate or a lack of tolerance, but rather because we're passionate about a truth. We need to be very clear about our understanding of God's plan for all of us. We have to understand our Christian anthropology, because that's what the law is then built on. We have to remember that we are afforded rights as religious people, even in the Australian Constitution. We have to remember that we're not a country that is based on individual freedom, that we're a country that's based on, in a sense, the common good, that freedom doesn't mean being able to do whatever one wants, just like the analogy of the piano player, that there are restrictions, but these restrictions and rules are what lead to beauty, what lead to truth, and what lead to freedom. I'm sure that most canon lawyers recognize that a new code of canon law is going to be needed for many reasons, not in the least regarding gender and sexuality. But for now, we live in a volatile time of change. We're in limbo, as it were. For we know what we believe. We understand the way of the world. But at this stage, we don't seem to have the structures which are necessary to assist us to effectively translate these core beliefs so that they can be understood in a rapidly changing world. Thank you.
That was Father Mark Podesta with Challenges to Christian Anthropology in Today's World, a Canon Law Perspective. This presentation was part of the Christopher Dawson Center for Cultural Studies 2016 colloquium on the theme, The Nature of Men and Women, Complementary but Different, which was hosted in Hobart, Australia. For more talks, interviews, and shows, visit cradio.org.au.